Probably the single biggest economic announcement for aviation over the last year was when Delta came out and said, for the first time in the history of any airline anywhere, the premium side of the business, the front of the cabin, was going to generate more revenue than the back of the cabin. And that is, to me, that is sort of an earth-shattering change to aviation.
Welcome to Hangar X Studios, where former fighter pilot and host John Ramstad takes us on a journey across aerospace as it enters an historic period of innovation and transformation. Our guests include aviation experts, pilots, financiers, military leaders, and innovators of all types. Buckle up for another episode of Hangar X.
All right. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Hangar X podcast. And thank you to all of you because we've now become one of the top podcasts in aviation and aerospace. And we're sponsored today by Hangar X Daily. Hangar X Daily uses an AI engine and it reads the 800 to 2,000 articles that come out every single day in this space. And we use our wisdom and our judgment to actually send you something that you can use to read the top 5 to 7 articles that you need to be aware of as a CEO, as an investor. So 5 minutes a day, we're going to try to keep you up to date on the most important innovations, capital deployments, breakthroughs by companies that you need to know about in the market. So go to hangarxdaily.com. You can sign up. We're launching this in the next couple of weeks, and it's going to be free to you. And with that, also, I'm so excited to have Dean Donovan back on the podcast. It was a year ago we had Dean on as we were launching. So, Dean, first of all, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be back.
It is. You know what? And, you know, when markets shift and new airplanes emerge and entire new categories start to kind of rise to prominence, like drones and VTOLs, and they're fighting for traction, there's few people that have, I think, a clearer view from an investor seat than you do, Dean, because this is a place that you've been in. So today, we're going to be talking about a couple, I think, really key concepts that are going to be very interesting to the audience. The first one is, where is capital actually flowing today between, you know, traditional business aircraft or some of these new innovations, between VTOLs, eVTOLs, the drone space? We're also going to be looking at, you know, what aerospace markets are real versus hype and what signals are investors looking at? Also, what are portfolio companies and how are they navigating some of their portfolio companies' certification, economics, and adoption rates? You know, what are driving some of the things that we're looking at? And also, what does 5 years look like out here with commercial aviation? There's so many changes right now. So, Dean, I'm going to read your bio here because I, you know, this is too awesome to memorize. By the way, I don't want to leave something out. So, you're the CEO of Diamond Stream Partners, and that's one of the most you're one of the most influential investors, in my opinion, in both aviation and aerospace. You founded Volaris, which became Mexico's largest airline. Previously, you led Bain & Company's global aviation practice, and you've invested in hybrid electric, unmanned, blended wing body airliners, fleet optimization, mid-mile cargo, and on and on. You have such an great perspective on where to deploy capital and why. I mean, you're the definition of the, like the Wayne Gretzky analogy, right? Skate to where the puck is going. And I think that's how you and your team are always thinking is, where's that puck going? And then how do we deploy capital and resources into where that's going? So, you know, here's how I'd like to start is maybe a market pulse. Because when we talked a year ago, there was a lot of enthusiasm around eVTOLs, air taxi, hybrid propulsion. I'd love to hear from you over the last year. Has there been anything that surprised you and anything that in terms of maybe market realities versus your expectations you had a year ago?
Yeah, so probably the biggest change from a year ago for the aerospace market and then, you know, by extension, the aviation market is just what's happened in defense investing. So, you know, and I think that's been a confluence of circumstances. One is over the last year, it's been become very, very clear that drones are the dominant force in the Ukraine-Russia war. And we can talk about that a little bit more, but it's not just short-term strike, short-range strike drones. It's medium, long-range drones, and all of that. And so that's one thing. The second thing is that the pressure that Trump has put on Europe to rearm through sort of withdrawing support from the Ukraine and drawing questions around exactly what kind of support the U.S. will give Europe in certain circumstances has caused the Europeans to rearm. And the pace and scale of that rearmament is nothing short of remarkable, even though it may still not meet the aspirational standards in every country and every place. And the U.S. has also reprioritized its defense resources on more innovative technologies. And that has really changed the funding environment a lot. It's changed the investing environment a lot in the space. And so you see companies that are pivoting into defense applications. Many of the companies we talked about last year, Joby Archer, so on, Beta, have pivoted into defense applications. And it's also sort of made it clear kind of the core technologies that are going to be foundational to the marketplaces in the future. And on top of that, we've got all kinds of commercial changes and large funding rounds that kind of express the enthusiasm for capital markets for some of these things.
Yeah, and as you talk about where things have changed, where do you see capital concentrating right now in the U.S. especially?
In the U.S., I'd say a lot of capital is flowing into defense-related stuff, but particularly dual use. So I think there's a recognition that pure play defense stuff is not necessarily a thing of the past, but it's not as attractive as dual use technologies. And, you know, aerospace is a complicated environment to invest in new technologies in, because typically the time scales are fairly long and before you can reach revenue or have a product. It's difficult to get commercial companies to pay for those development cycles. And so defense is a really nice way to sort of mature and develop a technology. And I'll get to a couple of examples in a second. And so, you know, if 18 months ago that looked like a longer shot or smaller scale, what we're seeing now is that people are making bets on that at a much larger scale. It's led by, you know, government funding. The NATO Defense Fund has funded a lot of private capital in this area. You've got the Office of Strategic Capital in the United States. And then you've got some, you know, very large scale funding events in, you know, a variety of different areas that are paving the way. And of course, the largest one of them all is SpaceX. But there are many others.
Yeah. And over the last year, have you seen some enthusiasm cool in certain areas that maybe were unexpected, or that, you know, as things were happening, you're like, okay, I get that now?
Yeah, I think the enthusiasm for all electric propulsion has, you know, really cooled off. And, you know, I think the aspirationalists, as I'll call them, who love the idea of, you know, a completely clean source of propulsion, I think have kind of finally lost the argument to the pragmatists. And so what you're seeing is you're seeing hybrid emerging. And we talked about this last year. It's been our view for a while as the dominant technology in the propulsion space, you know, where you're not into, you know, very large kind of turbine engines for commercial. So I think that trend has become very pronounced, where most of the major eVTOL guys have come out and they've created hybrid programs for their vehicles. And then you're starting to see the maturity of hybrid programs for fixed wing aircraft as well. Those mm-hmm. are starting to advance more. And then you're even starting to see hybrid programs for things like APUs, which is really interesting. So, you know, underlying all of that is an increased recognition, I think, and this is driven by defense, but is also true of commercial, where electrification of everything in the air makes a ton of sense. And, you know, Boeing really pioneered this with the 787. They got a little bit over their skis. But if you think about electric actuation instead of hydraulics, if you think about wheel tugs, if you think about, you know, power from a turbine on the ground as opposed to a hybrid system, if you think about propulsion on commercial, all of those things make great sense. But on military aircraft, you need tons of power for sensors. Increasingly, people are looking at laser weapons. People are looking at, you know, drone swarms and maybe deploying drones off of aircraft. And all of that requires lots and lots and lots of power. And so it's become clear, I think, in aircraft design and the design of the future, that you're going to need that power. And of course, behind all of that is the granddaddy, you know, power monger of them all, which is putting AI GPUs for computing on the edge. And that becomes more and more important as you're doing more and more work on the aircraft and you want real-time responsiveness. So that, you know, is probably the biggest power need of them all, and I think we're still in the very nascent stage of that, although I am starting to see some companies putting that kind of processing power into the flight computers or mission computers on drones.
Well, we just interviewed a company called Airgility, and they were tasked by I think it was either AFWERX or DARPA, but to create a drone that could autonomously fly through a window or a door, but to get the form factor, you know, the power needs, the sensors that had to be on there, then compute power to do that. They had a completely reimagined drone architecture. They were able to solve the problem. But also, when you're talking about power needs, we've had Eric Bartsch on from Vertigo twice, and yeah, we're going to have them back on again. But if you actually look at a turbine engine, and we don't really have one yet that's optimized for just a constant, you know, RPM run. That's not how a jet engine for an airplane is designed. But as we optimize engines to then drive a power plant sitting next to it on an aircraft to power either a propulsor or sensors or a combination of the two, I really think the design flexibility that's going to give the industry is going to have some significant breakthroughs, don't you think?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, we're already starting to see people talking about that stuff. Just a really simple example of that would just be in hybrid power, kind of in Eric's area, where, you know, you might do mission planning using some kind of LLM based interface, you know, on the edge. And so you might, if you're flying smaller aircraft, you might be flying into more residential areas or areas that have more noise restrictions, and you might actually incorporate flight planning elements into an electrically driven system that changes the tip speed as you fly over areas that are more densely populated, and then optimizes more for efficiency in other areas, just as one example. And you know, that would be very difficult, I think, to do with mechanical systems, just because the pilot workload to do something like that would be very, very high. You know, with kind of modern electrical systems and some of the kind of processing, flight planning processing that's going on in avionics now, I think that kind of thing will become a trend in the future.
Yeah, and there's some neat trends. Have you ever heard of the company Atule, Athule?
No. Uh-uh.
So we had them on the podcast, and they're using AI and supercomputers and machine learning to run 10,000 simulations, let's say, of a certain mission set. They also did one for a classified project, but they were able to reduce tip speed noise by 80% while increasing thrust 10%. in a new propeller design. Now, you could take that design, hand it to, let's say, Hartzell or Macaulay, and then they can, you know, put that on an airplane or a drone. But, you know, what AI is facilitating as far as just iterating, innovating quicker for very special uses like that, you know, are some very interesting. I think some other places that are going to be interesting to look at, if you actually look at as we've gotten more and more into the drones and learning drones, there's a layer there that nobody really talks about, and that's airspace management. Uncrewed traffic management is really, I think, going to be an enabling technology that, you know, there's 10,000 flights a day happening with very highly skilled air crews, air traffic control. It's very known. But pretty soon we're going to have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of flights a day from these small, you know, unmanned, you know, drones, you know, from small to large that have to fit into that airspace. And that's not going to happen until, we solve this almost this communication and control layer.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a lot of different people working on that. And they have been. I mean, that's an area where I think the software industry almost got in and saw the need too early. You know, AirMap was one of the great concept leaders in that space, but they were probably 10 years too early.
Too early, yep.
Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of that airspace management stuff comes with getting the national authorities to implement something systematically. And that's been a very slow process.
Yeah, it has been. Now, I've noticed in your portfolio, there's a lot more drones in there than there used to be. Some of the, you know, what's in there now. What segments are you seeing, Dean, that are providing more sustainable revenue and revenue growth versus these are a little bit more experimental, but we're willing to take on a little bit more risk in this category?
Right. So I think there's a few different things that we're seeing. So one is, I think we're seeing the integration of application stacks with drones, which is, you know, something that takes a while to mature. You know, drones are a hardware technology. They need to be reliable. They need to do the same thing every time. And, you know, the standard's pretty tough. It's a lot less forgiving than a software environment, especially when you're in the air. And so, you know, there's a set of layers, typically, even if you're just collecting data, between actually flying the hardware, but then planning the mission properly, and then integrating what you actually did into the mission planning, obstacle avoidance, right? Mm-hmm. All of that kind of stuff, just on the data collection side, that's actually a fairly complex set of geospatial data collection layers, integration of flight planning back into the activity that you're doing. And what I'm seeing is people are starting to make that happen. So if you take a look at Percepto, they're doing that with Drone in a Box.
Who's that, Percepto, you said?
Percepto, yeah. They're doing that for Drone in a Box. Super interesting application for doing regular inspections of infrastructure. You know, if you take a look at somebody like Wingtra, mm-hmm. You know, what they've done is they've actually moved from being a drone provider to being a solutions provider. So instead of having a non-integrated ground control station or ground control points, which require manual management, you know, you can get that integrated. And then once you've got that integrated seamlessly, you can do auto planning for the flight plan because you know exactly what kind of map you're trying to produce. If you try to do the flight plan without knowing exactly the map you're trying to produce, a lot of times you have to go refly it because you didn't integrate those two things closely enough. So kind of building a whole solution layer, even just around the data collection, is more complicated than what one might initially think. And I'm seeing that those applications have really started to mature. Another area that's maybe a little less complicated, but that's similar, is window washing drones.
Yeah. We just had the CEO of Drone Nerds on, and they're very excited about that. Is you know what they're going to do is not only they're going to actually provide training and a service. If you're an entrepreneur, they'll finance the equipment, provide you with all the training, show you how to market it, but then also provide you with the drones to go do that. I mean, that's kind of a game-changing idea.
Yeah, and it's actually kind of an interesting market. It's taking a market which is really small local businesses where it's four guys in a pickup truck, right? And it's giving those people a much more interesting job, which is they become a drone pilot. You can then do a much better job of washing the windows on a building. But while you're up there, you can also, if you want to change the payload out, you can look for cracks in the facade. You can look for other problems with the roof. And you could also paint. So, you know, now you've sort of completely restructured a lot of building maintenance, at least external building maintenance based on drone technology. And what you see is that not only are the drone companies sort of facilitating like what you talked about with Drone Nerds, but you see the private equity guys coming in and buying up the window washing businesses and building business service conglomerates because of the technology change. So it's a great example how...
You know, I haven't heard that. Are PE guys coming in and buying window washing companies?
Yeah, they are.
Rolling them all up so they can capitalize on this?
Yeah, because I mean it's you know, once you have the capital and the intelligence in the system as a core piece of the system, there's a lot more scalability to that business, so they become more interested in it. So it shows how when you destabilize one part of the value chain, you know, another part adjusts as well. So that's a super interesting area. So I see a lot of applications like that. On the flip side, going back the other way up the value chain, I think what's starting to happen is we're starting to separate out kind of the aircraft design piece from the manufacturing piece. And so you're seeing contract manufacturing deals like the one that Elroy did with Kratos.
Right.
And you're seeing people start to do that because it's very difficult to get the financing to build your own manufacturing plant. And you also need to build up, you know, a whole new level of core competencies to do that. And so I can see how, you know, we could have an industry that looks, you know, a lot of designers and a few manufacturers that support those designers. And I think the industry's going in that direction as well.
So, Dean, from your seat, are you more interested in the designer or the manufacturer, or how do you think about where you would deploy capital in a situation like that?
Yeah. So, you know, the question is, you know, how many startup manufacturers are going to be, and you know, there are some companies out there that are sort of talking about modular portable drone manufacturing. So that's kind of an interesting idea. I think it's an idea that has a lot of complexity to it. And, you know, I think a lot of the contract manufacturing deals right now are getting done, you know, with existing manufacturers who have experience of that. So that's sort of not the area we play in. Although I do think it's sort of intriguing, like, could you stand up a drone plant in a week and start building drones? Knowing actually what it takes to build hardware, though, I think that idea is going to need some time to mature.
Well, that'd be a week, you know, maybe 6 months, you know, maybe a year.
maybe 6 years.
Yeah.
We'll see. But it's an intriguing idea. You know, you'd need to, the aerospace value chain tends to be so supply constrained that it makes it difficult, I think, to set up ideas of that kind of thing because the suppliers have a lot of control over what happens. And that sort of stuff is happening at the same time that, you know, we've got another massive change in the market, which is the U.S. has basically banned DJI.
Right. So, you know, I was just going to mention that with the NDAA and the FCC, you know, rules now. And so then the demand for compliant drones, the manufacturers, both onshore and offshore, that have compliant drones, they cannot keep up with the demand. So there's this huge demand being created on the manufacturing side and the opportunity, depending on how you want to look at it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that actually creates the opportunity for business model innovation. If you have one guy there who's sort of totally vertically integrated and doing everything and is great at all the different pieces, which is DJI was, it's hard to think about competing at any level of that value chain, honestly. That's a pretty tough proposition. But now that speed is essential, I think it actually helps you think about, wow, should we be breaking this apart into pieces. If you do that, one of the really interesting questions is, how do you think about the aftermarket and where mm-hmm. is the drone business going in the aftermarket? Right now, it's like a 3-year life cycle, throw it away. If it breaks, I'll replace it with a new one and salvage the parts myself. But as you get into bigger and bigger BVLOS drones, people are going to expect those to have longer and longer life cycles. You're going to want to replace them. And then who owns the intellectual property for the tooling? Who owns the parts resupply business? Become very, very material questions for the people who design and build drones. That'll be an interesting battlefield.
Yeah, there's an emerging area in there too. What is your thoughts on the drone as a service offering that you're seeing more and more of?
Yeah, so that would be like Percepto as a drone as a service offering, right? And I really think it depends on what you're doing. So the thing that makes drone as a service work for Percepto, in my opinion, and we're not an investor in Percepto, I've looked at their business model, very impressive, is they put in infrastructure that has relatively high utilization, and it doesn't need to change location all the time. So if you have a bunch of oil field assets in location X, and you can use that drone, you know, 15 hours a week out of a box to look at that infrastructure because there's enough assets there, that is a great use of drone as a service, right? If you start to look at, okay, I've got a drone and I need to transport it somewhere to look at something once a month, which would be like a lot of construction projects, drone as a service starts to look a little less attractive. It looks more like a service business because you don't really want to hold an asset that's got really low utilization on it. So I think on drone as a service, it's going to be horses for courses. And then I'd say there's a third use case there, which is, hey, I've got an aircraft no one's ever seen before. No one knows how to operate. And I'm going to have to operate it myself as the OEM and sell it as a service because nobody's willing to stand up an aviation operation to run that vehicle yet.
I would like to see that design because that sounds fascinating.
Well, all of them are happening right now, so you'll see soon.
So, you know, how is your investment thesis, matured or transformed over the last 12 months? I mean, in you know, also looking ahead 1 to 2 years.
Yeah, so great question. I mentioned a little bit about Winged already, where they've transferred into the solution space, which is something that, you know, we had been pushing them to do for some time. So that's changed a lot. I think on the hybrid side, you know, as we talked about, defense has become much more important on the hybrid side as a source of things. But also, you know, there was a project that Ampere did with IAG and Embraer to explore APUs onto commercial aircraft. So we're seeing the expansion of hybrid into commercial aircraft, you know, on the immediate horizon before you put propulsion onto regional aircraft, which is really a very interesting development. And, you know, one of the things that I like for all of our portfolio companies is to have multiple ways to win. I'd like to have, you know, a defense way to win for a lot of our companies. I'd like to have a commercial way to win. And commercial, it's so big. I'd like to have the easiest commercial way and maybe the most valuable at the same time. So that's something that we, you know, we're focused on. We've seen a lot of movement in the BVLOS kind of part 108 space. So with Swiss Drones and Elroy transitioned their aircraft in the last year. They signed a deal with Bark, which is a big logistics player in the Middle East, to take early aircraft firm orders, early aircraft, have done a number of demonstrations, and they did the contract manufacturing deal with Kratos. So that's a very exciting period for them. And Swiss Drones has also matured its oil inspection business. So we're really seeing those kinds of part 108 propositions mature. And then I'll mention one that's not as aerospace related, it's more aviation related, which is the impact of LLM, natural language interfaces, on how aviation gets consumed. And
say more about that.
So I think this is an area that people in the industry have been talking about, but major announcements haven't been made yet. And there are experiments going on, but the real commercial impact of those haven't been established yet. So, you know, if you think about the current interface for buying a plane ticket, you go in and you say, hey, I want to go from San Jose to Cabo. And how much is that going to cost? But what you're really doing is you're trying to figure out, like, I kind of want a beach vacation. And like, I want to try to figure out how much it's going to cost to go to the beach and when it makes sense to go and so on. But the search cost of that's pretty high for the consumer, because not only would they have to look at multiple weekends, they might have to look at multiple locations, multiple airlines, and actually, like, organizing that through air is just the start. You're going to need a hotel. Part of the cost of the vacation is actually the taxi to get from one place to another when you get to the hotel. And so it's actually a very difficult and poorly researched product. So, you know, the LLMs aren't cheap, you know, and probably to do a, you know, a transactional based search for something that's very, very low fare, like a leisure trip someplace, is not very attractive. You know, you don't have very much margin on that as an airline, and it's very competitive, and the fees are very high, and that's going to be on top of the GDS fee or whatever you do. That's a very painful decision. But if you look at what the customer is actually trying to do, which is they're actually trying to plan an entire trip and see what it costs and see what their options are, LLMs are very good for that. And there's a lot more margin in thinking about how to use that kind of business tool for a trip like that, because hotels typically have higher margins than airlines. The overall ticket size is bigger. And so, you know, I think the entire process of travel could look quite different. And the secondary impacts of that, I think, are going to be quite interesting, because, you know, when was the last time you saw JSX listed when you did a search on Kayak?
I don't, and they actually fly here out of Centennial Airport, and we fly them to Dallas when we go. We have an office in Dallas now, and it's a phenomenal airline and experience. And you know, we know their founder, but they don't show up on. You know, you go to google.com/flights is kind of where I start. JSX doesn't show up on there.
That's right, or anywhere else.
And there's other companies like a JSX that also are not showing up.
That's right. So if you start to think about the proliferation of small aircraft solutions, shorter trips, more bespoke kinds of travel, you know, part of the barrier to that is aviation costs. Part of the barrier to that is just search costs for consumers, like getting things known. And so you end up, everyone ends up going to Cancun that has 72,000 hotels in, you know, 100 square miles or whatever, and it's great, but it's also not very bespoke. It's not very unique. And so I think you could look towards a situation where you can find a much more bespoke travel experience that actually ends up promoting kind of a mix of smaller or more unique destinations, because the search costs just go down.
No, that'd be fascinating, because, you know, I've used it to plan some trips over to Europe and other things, and I, you know, everything you're talking about, but it's very iterative. You got to do a lot of prompting. But as a service, I think that would take off, especially if, you know. Hey, let me do this as we kind of wrap up and kind of land the plane. Let me ask you this. I'm gonna have you put on your future hat a little bit. You know, if you look at some of the areas that you're looking at, is there an area of innovation that you're seeing right now that can create what would you consider a category leader, let's say 3 to 5 years out? Is there something like you're really keeping your eye on, because this has the potential to be that next thing we're all talking about?
So I'd say Jet Zero is that thing. I mean, okay. It's the blended wing body aircraft. They just completed their Series B funding round for $175 $1 billion. So very much in the keeping of these sort of bigger capital raises that have happened over the last year, like Beta. Obviously, everyone's going to go in on SpaceX's coattails for enthusiasm and whatnot. But there's also, some of these mechanisms like the Office of Strategic Capital and the NATO Defense Fund and things like that. So I think Jet Zero will have probably the most profound impact on aviation over the next decade, just because it's tackling the biggest part of aviation with something very, very revolutionary. And, 50% reduction in overall fuel burn, completely different customer experience. The fuel burn gets talked about a lot, but when you get into a blended wing body cabin where the walls are more vertical and it doesn't feel as claustrophobic, and you've got, potentially 6 or 8 different cabin areas instead of 2, just front and back, you end up with this gradations of premium service that you could never get in a tube and wing aircraft. And so I think, and there's also, it's going to be the most recent clean sheet aircraft. So you'll probably have more configurability in the aircraft, so you can switch around the aircraft a little bit much faster, much cheaper than you could switch around, say, an A320. And all of that, I think, is going to add to this increasing differentiation inside the cabin and taking the aviation business from a commodity business much more towards a bespoke business that has more significant premium elements. Probably the single biggest economic announcement for aviation over the last year was when Delta came out and said, for the first time in the history of any airline anywhere, the premium side of the business, the front of the cabin, was going to generate more revenue than the back of the cabin. And that is, to me, that is sort of an earth-shattering change to aviation. And I think it will...
Especially with your background, investing not only in airlines, but starting airlines. So you understand the economics better than anybody out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just something that we haven't experienced, right? Everyone has always said this is a commodity business, but I think the future is much more bespoke. You've got the LLM stuff on the one side, the AI stuff that's going to allow discovery of bespoke experiences, reduce search costs for consumers, and then you've got this increasing differentiation inside the cabin that's driven by IT and new aircraft designs by Jet Zero. It's going to be a much nicer way to travel. Might cost a little more if you want the really nice stuff, but the seats in the back will always be there.
It'll be interesting. We can talk next time too, but that blended wing body, when you actually get it flying, what are also the implications as we actually look at, different versions of that from, airliner scale down to something that's more, Elroy, autonomous drone cargo scale. Like there's some real implications to imagine that smaller with a hybrid electric power plant that's so much more efficient as it flies, like some of the companies that are trying to develop a laminar flow, private jet, but Jet Zero is going to change the game.
Yeah, for sure. And really all of these things combined, and we haven't talked about driverless cars yet, but all of these things combined are going to push aviation down below 500 miles. And it's going to start playing a bigger and bigger role. And then it's also going to play a role in labor substitution in robotics, which is, where we see Wingter going. And so instead of really being a transportation substitution, like I'm going to put things in the air instead of putting them in the car, I'm going to take someone's job who is really walking around, and I'm going to have the robot do the walking around for me and tell me what changed versus yesterday. And the new job is going to be, okay, what did it mean that this changed from yesterday, as opposed to what changed from yesterday? And that's a pretty big change. And you see this in war deployment. The whole thing with Iran right now, you don't hear anything about all of the cargo ships that are heading towards Saudi Arabia, although I'm sure there's some. It's all about the C-17s that are flying over there and deploying multiple missile systems. That would have been unthinkable in World War II, right? And that's all part of this pushing aviation into things that are dominated by other modes of transportation because it's becoming economically more efficient. That's pretty exciting for all of us in the industry, right? That grows your industry.
Yes. Dean, thank you so much. I'd love to have you come back on again. We got to do this in less than a year next time. So,
hey, anytime.